This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
And in Zen, I think it's usually best if we don't think too much about our practice, actually. People have said to me that sometimes when I talk, I sound like my teacher. Which just then I thought, oh my God, I'm sounding like my teacher. Anyway, this is not in any wish of any wish to imitate, but well, his and my voices are of a similar register, so there's that. But also, there's been quite a lot of imprinting. So anyway. Practice is, as I said before, is pretty straightforward. And although there's a temptation to, give it some kind of easily intelligible rational structure. We can also get to the point where we're actually kind of fiddling with it, which really won't help us. It'll probably make things more difficult. So what's the alternative? Well, the alternative in our Buddhist context, the alternative is what we call going for refuge. It may not be an exactly parallel concept in the West to going for refuge, but there is in Western religion this notion of faith. And there is some similarity there. As some of us were brought up with the understanding that faith simply means that you don't really question anything. That is, you, so to say, take it on faith, whatever you're being taught or told. And this is usually at a point in our lives, if we've been instructed that way, that becomes kind of unsatisfactory. And it's definitely unsatisfactory if it substitutes for being introduced in some fashion to what we might call the mystery. So if instead of being introduced to the mystery, you're simply given a menu of beliefs and directed to subscribe thereto, it's not so satisfactory. And that kind of approach, it seems to me anyway, my experience was, that kind of approach can lead really to a sort of rigidity. So to avoid that in our own context, well, of course, some of us have fled from that system. And some of us, like me, only discovered that after having fled, there is a mystery there that I fled from, but that I never heard about. I only got the menu. So I was a little displeased, and so sometimes I've thought, well, now that I know there's a mystery, I don't have to worry about the menu so much, I can just go back there. But it actually doesn't work that way. Really, we kind of need to grow up with the mystery, with that part of our being nourished and nurtured in a careful way. And because we are creatures embedded in language and culture, there's, you know, it involves words and symbols and so forth. So I found at least that I can't really just kind of walk back across the aisle, as it were. And one can visit, which I have done many times, and appreciate mystery, which transfigures the menu in a whole different way. But I don't think I can't really eat in that restaurant. Instead, I spent quite a few years, well, going for refuge, which is one way that in Buddhism, the mystery is introduced. And again, since we are creatures, in a sense, made of language, there are various words and explanations involved. So we say refuge involves three features: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And usually we hear first about the waking world manifestation of those. So Buddha is Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama, who devoted his life to studying the mystery with some success, I'd say. And that's Buddha. And then, but he realized or understood, that's called Dharma, teaching. And then the people who joined him, or join in his study, that's the Sangha. So that's like the waking world manifestation of the three treasures, where we go for refuge. And you may know the Sanskrit word, sharanam, or in Pali, saranam, means a safe place. And what's safe about it is it's a place where the dangerous currents of the world of samsara do not reach. What's so dangerous about samsara? Of course, that word, that Sanskrit word, it means like a flood or a flow. So it's as though we go swimming someplace where there's a riptide. It's kind of dangerous, you know? You can get swept away. And probably many of you, probably all of you, noticed some of those riptides. Well, what's the other one? Undertow. Ordinary life, so-called, has many attractions. And those attractions are, they kind of establish themselves in our minds and in society without benefit of Buddha's insight. And that means that they are kind of, actually, they are contrary to reality, which is what makes them dangerous. And so much immense karmic energy is put into that, involved in that flood, that it's dangerous. So we're told, well, we should go to a place of refuge where those waves lose their power, that undertow, that drag us off our feet. So we go to the safe place, Buddha's teaching, and the great community of those who study that way, the way of reality. And reality, of course, is a little mysterious. You may have noticed that too. Things arise and pass away, and the invitation is constantly there to treat things and people as more or less stable entities. But the more we study it, the more we realize stability is actually quite shallow and is a mere appearance. So then there's some feeling of mystery. What the hell is going on here? So at that point, we may be maybe a good time for us to be introduced to the mystery from the Buddhist point of view. So after we've studied and practiced a while, we may hear that Buddha is, you know, Shakyamuni, like we said, Siddhartha Gautama, the brass critter on our altar back there, making the gesture of earth touching. But then there's this other critter above or behind him. And that critter is named Amitabha. So his Sanskrit name is means Amita, which means not measured. And another word, Abha, which means radiance. So that is the Buddha of limitless radiance, Amitabha, or Amida in Japanese, Amito, or in Chinese. So wait a minute, how come there's the Shakyamuni guy, and then there's this other? And then, come to think of it, off to the left there is an elegant female figure standing, holding a vessel of some kind. And so we say, well, yeah, she is Guan Shirin, or Kanon, Kanzeon, which means listening to the world. And that's Buddha also, although she or he has a different name. And in the Indian context, that's a male figure, Avalokiteshvara. Somehow, moving east, her feminine side came to the fore. So now, we have a mystery where things and critters are even, they're not just changing names, they're changing genders and appearance. So then somebody may tell us that, when we say Buddha, we're going for refuge in Buddha. Buddha is actually nothing less than complete, perfect awakening. So we could say, Buddha is not even really exactly a person. So this view of the refuges is called the single body refuges. And this is more mysterious to us. So it's not even a person. There's just a blinding radiance called unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi in Sanskrit. So then, the Dharma is the radiance of that reaches beings. It's that awakening, and the Dharma is the fact that this reaches beings without a bit of dust. Completely pure radiance. And the, if you like, the effect of that is peace and harmony. So this is the somewhat more mysterious refuge. It's called one body. One body, the single body, three treasures. And then after maybe some more study and practice, we've gotten a little bit of a menu. And although the menu can get quite complicated in Buddhism, as you may have noticed. And some Buddhists like specialized in that. So you had some really, really smart people, Nagarjuna, Dignaga, Chandrakirti, and Tien Taijiri, and Dogen, and bunches of others who were just like really, really smart and had no trouble taking the menu and kind of standing it on its head and not just talking about what was served, but every little ingredient that went into every dish and how it was prepared. So we have that. And then we also have the mystery, which is this one body, triple treasure. And so after some experience with that, our feeling about our life is transformed. Again, kind of mysteriously. Although Buddhism can be read as promising a kind of pie in the sky thing, the way some other faiths sometimes seem to talk. The true power of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is realized in this life, in this body. So after some experience and practice, we may find ourselves kind of I don't know, happily engaged in making refuge available to others. So it turns out there's actually a third kind of triple treasure, a third kind of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So there's the manifested, just kind of like you can see and touch. There's the one body, which is very powerful, but you can't really touch. And there's this other one, which is kind of like maintained. That is, this is the three treasures that are treasured and passed along to others. And so there, Buddha means Buddha is still Shakyamuni. Buddha is still unsurpassed, perfect awakening. But it's also, they say, manifesting in vast space and in the red dust. And maturing beings amid the red dust. The red dust is a way of talking about our life. So here's Buddha again, but now Buddha is actually engaged in maturing beings. And in that context, Dharma, the second of the three treasures, is kind of expanded and turned into this enormous, I don't know, work of art. Dogen says something like, it's written on leaves and shells. And it's, he says, gathered into the ocean storehouse, which means this immense collection of Dharma, to which every being adds. And then the end result of that, the energy of that, is dedicated to releasing beings from suffering and from imprisonment in the house of the three worlds, to use Dogen's phrase. So we've kind of gone from our little bit naive, good-hearted, kind of childlike encounter with Shakyamuni Buddha and his teaching, or her teaching, and then other people who share our interest and study, and then we found out about something mysterious, which, because we can't grasp it, it remains pure. And that purity finds itself in our life and brings peace. And that stuff we can't grasp. We can just practice. We can't grasp it. And then we maintained triple treasure. That refuge is the expression of active practice in our life, where Buddha is manifesting in the red dust. Sutras are written everywhere. And beings are released from suffering. So that's a somewhat expanded portrait of going for refuge than I first heard. So I thought I'd share it with you this morning, since I sometimes find it hard to think of something to talk about. A former Zen Center abbot used to belabor his assistant and said, look, you've got to keep me supplied with topics, Dharma talks. So his assistant was always writing things down, you know, and he'd come in and suggest things. How about, no, how about, you know, how about, no, uh-uh. And then, you know, hopefully he'd come up with one. And of course, you could say you could talk about anything and there'd be some, how do you say, Dharma angle. And I think that's true. But I certainly have enough self-clinging that I want to feel like I'm earning my rice, as they say in Zen. You've got to earn your rice. Otherwise, people will stop feeding you. People sometimes ask me, well, what's your retirement plan, Reverend? Usually not people around here, because they know. But, you know, people who don't know much about our system. So I say, oh, I have a good retirement plan. I'm going to stop eating. People are like, oh, I see. Okay, well, I guess that's not going to cost very much. I said, no, it's not. It's cheap. So we'll see if things work out that way. Anyhow, that's one way of discussing refuge. And so when sometimes we chant the Pali, you know, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, I go to Buddha as safe place. I go to the teaching as safe place. And I go to the great community as safe place, mainly place away from the undertow and riptides. And that's you know, a fundamental aspect just about, I think, all Buddhists. And there's a huge variety, as you may know. There are as many Buddhist menus as there are any other kind. And just about all recognize the primacy of going for refuge, choosing a safe place to practice and learn about the world, and let that learning be of use to others in addition to ourselves. So this is why we can actually sit at peace. And you can hear the birds. And they are reciting those sutras. So that means we're all engaged in receiving and maintaining the three treasures, which is a tremendous benefit and gift. So I thank all of you for that. And sometimes I think I don't know what I'm talking about, so maybe that's just as well. But perhaps you have some questions or comments, or you would like to correct my view. That's okay, too. Yeah.
Thank you. You mentioned about filling and satsang. Is it okay to make a mistake?
Well, I'm afraid it's necessary. And, there's a lot of room for mistakes. And one of the joys of the Sangha jewel is our spiritual friends can help us. Because usually the mistakes are fairly straightforward. They kind of stick out. So before long, someone usually, hopefully, with a compassionate heart will come along and say, I think there's a little problem there. And then we can correct our effort maybe a little bit. If our understanding has started to tip in some way, we can learn what it means to once again go for refuge in this straightforward yet mysterious way and just keep at it.
The ministry and the land of the red dust,
yeah,
and the three worlds. I'm just sketching me. It's the three worlds. And is that like bonds between them?
That's the three worlds generally are thought to be the Kama Loka, you know, the Rupa Loka, and the Arupa Loka. The Kama Loka, where we hang out. The desire realm, and then the realm of pure form, and then the kind of disembodied realm. Those are usually the three worlds. And those are all within the great flood of samsara.
And so this, then the Sikkim you said also reminded me of how Sikkims are either Buddhas in every atom, there's countless Buddhas.
Right.
In the frequency or in the atoms.
Yeah.
And then you said that about the birds and the sutras and the birds.
Mm-hmm.
So do you like the crow sutras?
Not so much. I'm still working on that one. But that, you know, that's a good point. And I have enough self-clinging that I can still say, oh, shut up out there, you nasty birds. And the other day I was going to visit my brother on the BART train. I saw a beautiful hawk and these crows were harassing it. You evil crows, get away. I must work on this. Yes?
I have two questions, but the first one could just be a yes or no answer. Were you the assistant feeding the abbot?
I was not. I actually was not at that time. I was a mere, you know, newish student.
I see.
And I overheard him say, you know, you've got to supply me with topics, darn it.
So I see.
I thought, oh, I'd like to do that. Later I thought, no, I wouldn't.
Thank you for this really wonderful exposition on three triple treasures. And I liked what you said about the birds. I happen to love crows myself.
Oh, good. I'm glad somebody does.
Can you help us take what you've explained now and bring it back around to not thinking too much about our practice? And does what you said about the birds have something to do with that?
Well, since you bring it up, what would you say?
Well, I'd say yes.
I'd say yes, too. Yeah.
Yes.
I started out by saying our practice is fairly straightforward, at least around here. One of the ways we demonstrate going for refuge is we just sit down and sit still and kind of set aside fiddling, right? And simply breathe in and out and observe the world arising and passing away without grasping or rejecting. So that's pretty straightforward practice, and yet all of the approaches and all the refuges are contained there. In that practice, there's certainly the single body, unsurpassed perfect enlightenment, or Buddha, and its complete purity and peace. This is all demonstrated there very, very, very handily, although possibly in a way that our intellect isn't quite satisfied by. And that's all right, as long as we don't get trapped by thinking, therefore, there's something wrong. So our practice is in perfect harmony with these three kinds of triple treasures, which is where its power and beauty comes from. So I would say no need to fiddle with that very much.
footnote. I remember your teacher, he was my teacher too, in the 80s saying that Zazen was like sitting upright in the middle of an avalanche or a rock slide.
Mm-hmm.
So they had that like you were talking about, that flood of samsara, but then gathering, as you said last week, a couple of weeks ago, not a ceremony, but sort of uprightness.
Mm-hmm.
Uprightness, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the ground beneath our feet shifts suddenly, especially in San Francisco, and sometimes enough that it can cause some problems. So it's good if our experience of our uprightness and stability is not necessarily based on just the literal ground or floor. So to have this experience of being simple-hearted in the midst of everything that is ongoing establishes and familiarizes ourselves with that uprightness, so that when things get hairy, as they do, the upright heart is not particularly perturbed. I mean, yeah, there's some challenge involved, obviously, but there isn't a lot of confusion. So that's kind of the function of that ceremony. Uprightness is, in the midst of the great flood, where is that refuge? Well, it's in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we finally learned that that's here. Well, again, thank you all for joining in this practice. And next week, we have a guest speaker, Reverend Cynthia Keir, will give the Dharma talk. And, upstairs, I believe there are cookies and tea for one and all. So please join us. Thank you very much.